This is Brigitte Moucher, and it is the second episode of the Solari Report Wellness Series. For today's discussion, I chose a topic that should be of interest to everybody. It has been the object of a lot of hype and therefore needs some demystifying. The topic is longevity, healthy aging, or growing young. Our guest today is Dr. Vesna Skull. Dr. Vesna has been helping her clients live healthier, longer lives for many years, using a holistic approach to health and wellness. Some of the ideas we are going to discuss with Dr. Skull include the future of medicine, but also what we can do today to increase our lifespan. Dr. Skull is a graduate of Rush Medical College in Chicago. She's a board-certified specialist in internal medicine, a fellow of the American College of Physicians, and an associate professor of medicine at Rush University. She's also fellowship trained and board certified in anti-aging and regenerative medicine. She is the medical director of Cellular Intelligence Medical Spa in Chicago, which focuses on wellness and beauty from the inside out. For many decades, Dr. Skull has been recognized by Chicago Magazine as one of the best doctors for women in Chicago and top primary care doctors in Chicago. She was ranked as one of the nation's top doctors by U.S. News. She was awarded top 5% of Chicago metro area physicians by Superdoctor and regional top doctor by Castle Connolly year after year. Dr. Skull is also a wonderful human being. In her spare time, she enjoys hiking, listening to classical music. She is a certified raw organic chef and an avid organic gardener. Dr. Skull is also involved in a medtech startup, bringing to market a very promising solution for personalized acute and chronic pain management, which also offers cellular tissue and nerve repair and regeneration. Dr. Skull is a firm believer in personalized medicine and has a pretty good idea of what the future of medicine will look like. Dr. Skull, welcome to the Solari Report Wellness Series.
Thank you so much, Brigitte. It is lovely to be here.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. So, in the next few decades, life expectancy in the developed world is supposed to increase to 110 to 120 years. I'd like to hear from you how realistic or likely you think this is, and what are the greatest promises for health span improvement. At the same time, we are hearing that children being born today have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. Could you clarify this for us?
So you're right, Brigitte. I think that human organism definitely has a potential to live well into triple digits. And a lifespan of much longer than our current actuarial 80-something is a possibility, despite the recent release of those grim statistics that you mentioned regarding our children, which in many ways reflects our epidemic of obesity and antecedent chronic disease development that we are seeing in individuals of a much younger age. So as we're making huge strides in precision personalized medicine through advances in technology, such as complete genome sequencing and ability to use this information preventively, understanding the importance of our genetic makeup and the potential to alter the expression of those bad genes and enhance optimum function, we are also having to be keenly aware that our modern world, with all of its beautiful new technologies, conveniences, and such, is very likely adversely affecting our long-term potential for our long-term health and well-being because of toxins and stress that all of us are a part of. For those children not to become actuarial truths of those grim predictions that they're not going to outlive their parents, I think the basic tenets of healthy living need to be respected, and we need to readopt them. And many of our habits, consequences of the fast-paced life of the post-industrial era, need to change. Why not learn from centenarians around the world, from the blue zones? They all have things in common that I will try to summarize for us here. We absolutely must insist on the clean environment and stop its pollution. And here I mean, you know, pollution from anything that we contribute to personal care, anything that we put in the air, in the water, plastics, pesticides. We must put a stop to glyphosate and poisoning our food supply. And we must eat real food, not food lookalikes, but real food, a rainbow of it, mostly organic, mostly plants. We mustn't forget to move, but we surely should not become, you know, victimized by every fad that comes along of a over-exercising frenzy that most people will do for 5 minutes and then abandon. So purposeful exercise, which gives us pleasure and accomplishes a task, should be our daily goal. We mustn't forget to sleep. Americans are absolutely chronically deprived of sleep. And we should also strive not only for 7 to 9 hours of sleep, but good quality of it. We should sleep in a clean environment, free of toxins and electrosmog, and cooler temperatures. We mustn't forget the importance of relationships, social belonging. We should practice some form of meditation, mindfulness, progressive relaxation, all with the intent of activating the parasympathetic tone and counteracting the daily assault of stress. You know, returning to prayer and actually seeing how a prayerful life actually extends one's ability to fight even some of the serious illnesses is becoming studied by even allopathic medicine, as it seems to have a positive effect. So in summary, managing stress and adequately getting rid of toxins on a daily basis in a sound is a sound foundation of a paradigm that I'm teaching to all of my patients. We should all be living long and dying short. So extending healthy lifespan should be the goal, but without the burden of debilitating and chronic illness.
That makes a lot of sense, and I definitely agree. So we also hear about other serious threats to our health coming from EMF radiation, for instance, especially from 5G. So do you think that our bodies have a chance to adapt fast enough, or at least children's bodies? Or do we need to take more drastic measures to protect ourselves?
Well, you know, FCC claims that the degree of daily exposure of an individual to various forms of EMF, which actually, by the way, average individual in the U.S. is exposed greater than 10 hours per day to screen time, be it from phones, tablets, computers, TV screens, radiation from smart meters, fluorescent and LED lights. And while they tell us that that is safe, much different data actually emerged and continues to be built upon after an international task force released a bioinitiative report 2012. This report has been formally updated as recently as 3 years ago, but Dr. Ron Powell, a physicist from Harvard, who formerly worked for the government, wrote a report summarizing those findings in 2015, and Dr. Lai addended it with more additional research just this summer. So the report essentially presented why there should be a rationale for biologically based exposure standards for low-intensity electromagnetic radiation versus thermal ones. So what that means is that currently, you know, unless you're frying yourself, staring at your screen or sitting in front of your smart meter, FCC is saying that you're safe. That is old news based on research of 30 years ago. The United States, unfortunately, has not been quick to jump on board of some of these recent discoveries, and I think that impact of EMF is really profound. Some of the European countries, such as France and Israel, for instance, earlier this year banned Wi-Fi from their elementary schools. For those who are, you know, questioning whether this is being overly aggressive or overly fearful, there are over 1,800 new studies which report abnormalities from ranging from gene transcription, from direct toxicity to our genome, and to our single and double-stranded DNA damage, to condensation of chromatin and loss of the DNA's capability to repair itself in human stem cells, reduction of free radical scavengers, which are the molecules that are helping us deal with oxidative stress, to effects and neurotoxicity in humans and animals, carcinogenicity in humans, serious impact on human and animal sperm, both morphology and function, and affecting offspring developmentally and behaviorally. You know, I often wonder, why am I in my 35 years of practice in the last decade seeing so many healthy young couples having challenges conceiving? I am quite certain that EMF is playing at least some role in some of those circumstances. And then, you know, when we consider the statistic that 92% of the world's population lives in the environments where outdoor pollution exceeds the World Health Organization ambient air quality guidelines, it is a bit difficult to think that in life of one generation, namely our children, we could see the adequate adaptive genetic mechanisms to solve this enormous problem of a burden of electrosmog that we've created for ourselves. So if we're to help these kids overcome the odds of their shorter life expectancy, we basically need to look at both our genes and the environment. And, you know, we are much more likely to affect some positive change through environmental actions, because it'll take us a while to see what happens with gene manipulation and how that research affects us and decreases our risk of exposure. So I think that environmental control is really, really necessary and very urgent, just like you said.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any particular recommendation for effective protection against EMF?
So now that I've told you that we've created our urban doom and gloom, and we really should all be walking around in aluminum suits and or armor, that is not very feasible. But there are definitely things that we can do. First, I think we need to define and figure out if we are at imminent risk of EMF. And there are devices commercially available. One that I particularly use and recommend to my patient is a very moderately priced device called Acousticon that detects safe and intermediate and dangerous levels of radiation. And typically, as we move around our home, where you could see those levels vary relative to the distance from the source. And in an urban environment like a high rise in Chicago, for instance, being near a window where surrounding buildings and towers, both cellular and TV antennas, are emanating a lot of radiation, where our own in-home Wi-Fi, you know, the faster the network, the 5Gs of this, you know, that are propelling all of our devices are creating unsafe amount of radiation. Well, try to move them to part of the home where you're not so close in. And definitely, besides the distance, there's also enclosure. There are a few commercially available stainless steel cages that one can buy, but there's still not 100% because there is room around the devices where radiation can still occur, using simple things as aluminum mesh that is available, you know, in any hardware store can protect those devices and make them much more safe for us while not impeding their intended efficacy in emitting the signal, or in a case of a smart meter, allowing the power company to get the adequate reading.
Good. So I know you like simple solutions, and it seems like this definitely works, because you're measuring it, and you think it's also effective for 5G, right? Because you have 5G already in Chicago?
Yes, yes. And you know, enclosing it definitely decreases. But again, it also is dependent on your proximity to the all of the devices. Whenever possible, I counsel my patients to work on their computers in wired rather than amount of exposure is much less.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so now could you help us understand the biology of aging and what the top factors are that influence the aging process? So this may become a little more technical. Maybe you can start by defining and discussing DNA methylation and epigenetic clock, and then maybe discuss the latest discoveries in epigenetics.
So biology and science of aging has given Nobel Prize to several wonderful researchers in the last decade. Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn for discovery of telomeres in 2009. Dr. Paul Modrich just a couple of years ago for DNA changes in aging and how those contribute. And among those DNA changes, methylation is a process currently believed to be most prominent molecular marker for monitoring of aging and predicting life expectancy. However, the mechanism underlying this age-related DNA methylation changes is still mostly undiscovered. And a great article just published this summer on this topic sort of elucidates that a bit, yet the scientists are still working on the mechanisms. Now, as far as the epigenetic clock, UCLA geneticist Steve Horvat led a team of 65 scientists in seven countries to record age-related changes to human DNA, calculate the biological age of human blood, and estimate then a person's lifespan based on that. And the higher biological age, regardless of chronological age, consistently predicted an earlier death in an individual. So drawing on 13 different data sets individually and then different data from landmark study of Framingham Heart Study in the 70s and more recently, late 80s, early 90s, Women's Health Initiative, a consortium of 25 institutions analyzed the DNA in blood samples from more than 13,000 people in the United States and Europe. And they applied a variety of molecular methods, including an epigenetic clock developed by Horvat. They measured the aging rates of each individual. The clock calculated the aging of blood and other tissues by tracking methylation, which is a natural process that chemically alters the DNA over time by adding a methyl group, and by comparing chronological age to the blood's biological age, the scientists then used the clock to predict each person's life expectancy. Interestingly, in that process, in that experiment, they discovered that about 5% of population seems to age at a faster biological rate, resulting in shorter life expectancy.
And there are no known reasons for this?
Well, not aware of any at the moment. And, you know, as we elucidate this, maybe it will become clearer. Because those preliminary findings, you know, may explain why some individuals, despite following a nutritious diet, exercising regularly, drinking little to none, and not smoking, seem to die young despite all of that. However, you know, you have to put all of that in perspective, and when risk factors are given statistical weight in all of these analyses, risk factors like smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure still predict mortality much more strongly than one's epigenetic aging rate. And in this particular instance, you know, that small cohort of people in whom we saw the earlier than expected life expectancy. So as the population ages and ages rapidly, and we expect that by 2050, the number of people over 60 will actually double from accounting for about 11% of population to 22%. We really, as a medical community, have to urgently find some interventions that would prolong healthy living and not just existence, by 5 to 20 years. And as Horath points out in his work, he says, we don't really have time to follow a person for decades to test whether a new drug or a new procedure will work. And by using this epigenetic clock formula, if you will, they can actually evaluate the effect of anti-aging therapies in as little as 3 years. So this gives us hope to then put into action, besides the environmental and lifestyle modifications, some of these new therapies much more quickly than what ordinarily takes to approve a drug or a therapy, which is an average of 7 to 11 years.
Yeah, definitely. So if we look at epigenetics, what have we learned and what are we still learning?
So, you know, epigenetics is, when I was in med school, we didn't know what epigenetics was. And I really wasn't in med school with dinosaurs. It was only nearly 40 years ago, 35 years in practice. But even in the early years of my practice, we didn't know what epigenetic possibilities were, but epigenetic processes affect the expression or activity of genes without changing the underlying DNA sequence. And they're believed to be one mechanism by which environment can then interact with genome and not necessarily changing it. So there are a lot of studies, very recent all this year, that look at twins and their changes in development of certain conditions based on environmental exposure. For instance, there are studies that also look at genetic material, namely one published just in October of this year, paternal transmission of epigenetic memory via sperm, talks about how actually the father's behaviors and health and developmental issues can be transmitted via sperm to the offspring. So, you know, we kind of knew that it's important to prepare for healthy pregnancy and healthy children, but we didn't really know that paternal contribution can also bring in those factors that were not previously measured.
And I suppose that's true for women as well, right? Especially during pregnancy.
Well, you know, some of the older data that probably was an impetus for researchers to look at male contribution to this environmentally induced cellular memory kind of behavior things that can be conferred via sperm and an egg, looked at female oocytes or egg contribution to epigenetic memory. So yes, both women and men who are planning to get pregnant need to do everything in their power to basically clean up the slate beyond their best behavior, so to speak, and embrace the healthy behaviors way before they're contemplating conception. And, you know, when you look at that, in the U.S., over 50% of pregnancies are not planned. That kind of makes us think, I guess we're not giving our children the best position right from the get-go, and there needs to be more conscious effort to really prepare for a healthy pregnancy, which is one of my conversations with my younger patients in terms of mapping out their health and wellness and health behaviors as to how to positively affect the outcome of not only healthy pregnancy and healthy baby, but that baby's life expectancy and health.
That's great. So if we look at all this, what is the promise of for us in terms of increasing our lifespan and staying healthy? So based on everything we know at this point.
So, you know, newly developed techniques could brawl this already advancing field rapidly to complement modern medicine and outcomes. And as we said, the epigenetics is a study of mechanisms by which genes are turned on or off without altering their genetic code or DNA sequence is one of the ways that cells regulate gene expression. Epigenetics has helped scientists better understand very complex and diverse biological processes such as cell differentiation, genomic imprinting, X chromosome inactivation, and operates via two mechanistic processes. A histone modification, for instance, methylation, acetylation, ubiquitination, phosphorylation, carbonylation, all these lations are processes whereby the body or the cells alter their proteins. And, you know, older theory of aging had to do with free radicals and their neutralization and when, you know, we need oxygen to survive, but oxygen also oxidizes us and makes us rusty, so to speak. So the free radical theory of aging still is prevailing, but the DNA changes in proteinome or nucleome changes are now really becoming a hallmark of this aging process. And then if we can change these proteins from being made or denatured, we can possibly have an effect on extension of life or prevention of certain diseases. The second mechanism whereby this can be measured in health and it happens is via direct methylation of cytosine base pairs. This is what we've talked about in the beginning, the methylation of the DNA. So by altering those proteins by chemicals, we can affect the aging and the disease expression. Accumulations of them within the cells can lead to, again, more rapid development of certain diseases, particularly neurodegenerative kind. And if we can affect them through these biochemical reactions based on our genes, but not altering our genes, we can figure out what it is that makes people age faster or slower, and then, you know, put roadblocks and or facilitate traffic, if you will, in the positive direction.
So just to summarize a little bit, so according to epigenetics, we are not totally determined by our genes, and we can use lifestyle and other things like supplements, meditation, and other things to influence their expression, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, Brigitte. Our genes really kind of provide the canvas and the environment, complete with our best behaviors, dietary choices, prudent supplementation, and stress management helps paint the healthy or, if we choose, a not-so-healthy picture. Or, you know, another way of saying, and that is one of the quotes that one of my favorite people in this field, Dr. Jeffrey Bland, who is the father of functional medicine, says, genes load the gun and environment pulls the trigger.
Yeah. So, and then it seems like we are starting to understand how aging happens, but we still don't know exactly why. And but because we understand how we age, we are able to affect and possibly reverse the aging process. Is that correct?
Well, I guess yes, in a sense. Molecular biologists have been, you know, debating and fascinated by some interesting phenomena in single cell organisms like bacteria and some invertebrates, worms, and have put forth some elegant theories of, quote, cellular immortality, end quote, that actually may have some application to humans, but definitely clinical applications don't seem exactly around the corner about this yet. But we are getting there.
Uh-huh. And so it also seems like we can make changes to our lifestyle and also using some chemicals to affect our gene expression. And anybody at any age could make those changes and see an effect, right? A positive effect.
Oh, I always tell my patients it's never too late. Okay. So yes, you're absolutely right. There is no age limit at which point some of the very well understood interventions of improving life quality and likely affecting longevity should or should not be implemented. If you've never walked, if you've driven to your mailbox 300 feet, just merely not getting in your car to pick up your mail and walking 300 feet on day one is a victory. In fact, I have a little vignette. Years ago, I had a patient who was morbidly obese, and we worked on helping him through lifestyle lose weight. And one of the components thereof was moving. He was motivated because at age 40, he became a first-time parent. He literally was driving from his garage to pick up his mail. Little by little, daily changes led to the fact that when his baby girl was 5 years old, he's in the Guinness World Book of Records for the first individual who has climbed the vertical mile going up and down the Eiffel Tower in 5 years. So huge difference from driving to the mailbox to climbing Eiffel Tower so many times as to complete a mile. And in his health parameters, all of the chronic disease markers have disappeared. I have remained actually in contact with this person who was destined to actually fail, because unfortunately obesity has such a high rate of recidivism, and 95% of people who lose significant amount of weight regain it back. But we've remained in contact, and over the last 25 years, he had fluctuated about 10 pounds and had clearly added at least a decade, if not more, to his life. So better nutrition, physical activity play a huge role. Physical frailty due to sarcopenia is frequently a reason for the elderly people's demise and or premature death. So strengthening the skeleton and muscle, and therefore reversing sarcopenia or low muscle mass, has been shown in many studies to contribute both to increase in longevity and improvement of quality of life. Now, fancier newer technologies will also likely work across the ages, but we'll know more about those in due time. There's absolutely nothing stopping us to control our hand as to what goes in our mouths and to control our purchasing power of clean versus not so clean dietary and personal care products. And there's nobody stopping us in taking a step and being physically active.
Yeah, I agree. I also say it's never too late.
Absolutely.
So now if we look at some technologies in this field, what do you think is really promising?
So I've been looking at the field of medical genetics and gene sequencing for over a decade, and have initially started screening some of my high-risk patients with genetic assays, which were for clusters of certain cancers, to help them make a therapeutic decision, as to proactive action if there was a clustering of certain cancers, particularly breast cancer, ovarian cancer, reproductive cancer, and then other types of genetic syndromes where colon cancer was included, or other internal GI, specifically organs or endocrine organs. So for years, we were able to identify the high-risk individuals and, look at these specific genes that may affect certain, illnesses. But more and more in the last 3 or 4 years, there have been a lot of companies that are bringing to market technology of complete human genome sequencing, and then within realizing what our genes look like, looking at a couple of methods which have epigenetic assessment and intervention make it a possibility. Two such assays, one called ACE and another called CRISPR have the potential to dramatically enhance the epigenetic research and its clinical applications. And what do I mean by that? So they really come to us as tools that the scientists will have to better explore, you know, fundamental questions about how a particular person will react to a specific medication, or, you know, how they will react to a specific cancer drug, or analyze the health of an embryo obtained naturally or via IVF, help with tumor diagnosis, and help our assay for presence of certain markers of neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. So the range of diseases that may be treatable by epigenetic protocols may explain why there are companies emerging, such as Gotham Therapeutics and Epigenomics. They've launched multi-million dollar drug discovery programs that focus on discovering epigenetic modulating drugs and, you know, relying on these assays and the technology to help them be very precise, very specific. So if epigenetic research utilizing these technologies will successfully shed some light in disease prevention, diagnosis, and therapy, then the research can expand to study epigenetics related to human behavior, moods, aggression, violence, things like adultery, sexual preferences, risk-taking, happiness, depression, even spirituality may all be affected by gene regulation, including epigenetics via mechanisms not yet precisely defined. Now, using that science for this subgroup of patients and outcomes and endpoints may be a little shakier and less certain than helping people overcome an illness and or prevent one. And while all of this is elegantly unfolding and, you know, helping us sort of pick designer drugs for treatment of certain conditions, there's also much, much evidence that diet, sleep, fasting, exercise, and stress, or managing it, regulate gene expression. And, you know, we keep coming to that. It is very, very important that we need to make those recommendations while also exploring the way those behaviors that are common sense are actually able to affect the epigenetic expression.
So do you think that these new technologies have a chance to be available to everybody anytime soon?
Well, you know, that's a loaded question, Brigitte, in our 2018 America, in our healthcare system. You know, our country truly has a potential to be the absolute leader in healthcare and healthcare innovations. But I think at the moment it has to figure out how to afford access to care to its population, even at a basic level. So while the last decade has certainly seen huge strides in making many of the diagnostic and therapeutic interventions available to general population, it's still hard to predict the time frame for these innovations to be universally available. Now, for instance, I can tell you I have knowledge and awareness and ability to interpret over a dozen elegant, beautiful tests that, you know, I can have my engaged well patients, not necessarily patients with a disease, but people who are proactive and wanting to stay well, use to assess their current state of well-being and to help predict the future, looking at the, you know, microbiome, looking at their hormonal evaluation, the specific, if not full gene sequencing. So while it's definitely there, technology is there, scientifically proven, it's working, but these are all still considered, quote, experimental by insurance companies and third-party payers, and therefore only available to a selected minority. So the paradigm of our healthcare dollars, which are still largely spent for disease management, has got to be abandoned, and focus needs to be shifted to health maintenance, education, prevention, research, and development. And then we may maybe see some of these new technologies penetrating into the mainstream and being more available to population at large.
Yes, definitely. So shall we talk now about your vision of the future of medicine? What do you think it's going to look like?
Well, you know, I believe that in not too distant future, we will adopt as standard of care intelligent family planning through careful preconception counseling, not only genetic screens in high-risk population, but longitudinal mapping of like parental behaviors and habits leading to conception, and taking effort to really clean up their house and their lifestyle and environment, starting with one's own home, choice of a clean, wholesome diet, perhaps, you know, best suited to their own genome, because we can figure out via genetic determination what is the best diet for you. It may not be the same that's best for me. Complete with then appropriate exercise, which will then yield the highest success rate in achieving a natural or supporting pregnancy from assisted intervention. So preconception care and planning, and then the baby's born, and at birth, babies will not only have the opportunity to have their own cord blood saved, but may have it genetically sequenced to alert the parents to any possible future health challenges and allow them then to select the lifestyle most suitable for that baby and promotion of health and prevention of disease. And then at some point in adolescence or young adulthood, banking one's own stem cells may become a norm. There's, you know, also research underway to create induced pluripotent cells in the laboratory and have them available to address many health problems in adults' life if one does not get to bank their own stem cells. Now, sadly, a lot of the medical community still believes that this is far-fetched and, you know, very far from clinical implications, but I do believe that we are onto something with looking at the pluripotent, meaning ability to assume the characteristics of any tissue where it's injected stem cell that, you know, can be generated either in a laboratory, and that's, you know, not here yet, but currently available sources include placental tissue, because placentas don't know who they are. They don't know that they're baby or their mother, and that therein lies the beauty of their cellular content, which can then be used for, you know, currently in orthopedics, joint repairs and, you know, regrowing tendons and regrowing muscles, etc. So should one there develop an evidence of malfunction in adulthood, primarily through like acute injury, but also as a consequence of some chronic maladaptive behaviors, the emerging science of energy medicine and neuromodulation is also come into play and can provide restoration of normal processes through a complex exchange of information between the environment and the organism on a cellular level. So that's kind of a broad brush and generalization of what I see happening in not too distant future, Brigitte.
Thank you. And so what solutions do you think will bring the biggest benefits?
Well, you know, at the present time, I think the jury's still out on a universal use of some already available diagnostic tools, because they're either considered experimental, like I said before, or still not affordable to many people. Common sense approach, in my book, always wins. So even in the absence of knowing one's own complete genome, which would bring about the greatest benefit because we could be precise in terms of preventive strategies or early intervention, we should adopt the universally proven approach to extending our lifespan through lifestyle choices. Never, never wrong is to adopt clean living practices. So there's a huge body of evidence supporting that approach, and all it takes is an informed patient and an appropriately educated healthcare professional to guide the patient through the maze of information and misinformation on the subject. You know, for decades, I've been telling my patient that, Mediterranean type diet or modified Mediterranean is the healthiest diet on the planet. And only in the last 18 months, there have been three huge studies supporting not only that, but actually now giving statistical improvements in longevity, enhancement of one's life by a significant number of years or percentages, and prevention of neurodegenerative diseases. So clearly, our lifestyle choices play a huge, huge role with the greatest benefits.
And if we look at the new technologies, therapies, or drugs, what would be your top picks today?
So this year and part of last have brought us actually some very interesting new and revisited old longevity breakthroughs. So thermal effects on the body, use of heat, such as in sauna, and actually doesn't have to be any particular sauna type of sauna, although infrared frequencies seem to be the best in this. By increasing the heat shock proteins in the body, which prevent clustering of proteins within the cells that can cause degeneration, such as in Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, and activating the XO3 gene, the anti-aging master gene, is increased with heat. So, you know, if you have the opportunity to sit in a sauna once or twice a week, better yet, if you have one in your home, that may actually indeed prolong your life. Use of platelet-rich plasma or, you know, growth factors derived from stem cells, but PRP, not just for decrease in wrinkles, but also to enhance recovery from injuries and stimulate hair growth would be another pretty impressive discovery. And increasing muscle mass, it is directly related to decrease in aging. Mellow and colleagues showed that strength training reverses gene expression in 179 genes to their youthful level. Just a little bit of weight work, and it doesn't have to be, you know, becoming a bodybuilder. About 10 minutes, three times a week, will sufficiently increase the muscle mass to also positively correlate with the age of one's brain. In other words, making our brains go younger, published in Journal of American Geriatric Society. In terms of plethora of nutritional supplements that are out there, you know, identifying a few winners as it relates to oxidative stress and prevention of disease and increase in longevity, definitely supporting healthy glutathione levels is a key. This tripeptide, tripeptide consisting of glycine, glutamic acid, and cysteine, sharply decreases as we age and, you know, basically hits the basement shortly after 40. And it is one of the most potent antioxidants. Research at University of Michigan, Denmark, University of Naples, Italy, all showed that the higher levels of glutathione in octogenarians, average 87 years of age, but patients ranged from 60 to 100, was found to directly correlate with decrease in all illnesses. So in other words, you know, glutathione steadily decreases 40 and older, but if we can increase it through what? Well, we can increase it through ingestion of cruciferous vegetables, the undenatured whey protein, and or a supplement with its precursor, namely N-acetylcysteine. Glutathione will serve as an incredible antioxidant, and in part of the theory of aging that we alluded to that deals with oxidative stress, it is very important to keep us young. Another old supplement is an herb that dates and has its use in traditional Chinese medicine since 100 years before Christ, and it's astragalus. Its rediscovered value has shown that it has immune benefits in wound healing and brain health, and decreases inflammation, improves insulin sensitivity. But in a couple of studies last year, it also showed remarkable benefit in slowing the shortening of telomeres. And we've alluded to telomeres as becoming a measure of cellular aging, and for which Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn received a Nobel Prize in 2009. Telomeres, for just to refresh everyone's memory, are, you can think of them as the little plastic tips and shoelaces. With every cellular division, as we are aging, the tips become shorter. And with every assault from oxidative stress or other toxic influences onto the DNA, the tips become shorter. So the DNA strands that are tightly held together may unravel if the tips or the telomeres become so short that they can't really hold them in place. That's when the external influences can really get to work and alter and damage our DNA, causing all sorts of mutations in the chromosomal level and expression of disease. Another on a nutritional support category are oligomeric proanthocyanidins, OPCs. Those are the extracts from dark skin fruit that render the dark skin berries in particular extremely powerful in their antioxidant power. And when mixed with some other ingredients which detoxify on a cellular level and enhance the production of nitric oxide, you know, those have been some findings that are really correlating very positively with increasing longevity. An old habit of, you know, cultures where fasting was a religious or spiritual practice has come into vogue. So although I do not support any diet per se, the intermittent fasting diet may actually be just a habit of eating and timing your food, because by fasting and in intermittent fashion, scientists have found that telomere length also increased. The animal studies in Spain showed that when they reduced the caloric intake in mice by 40%, they lived 20% longer. Now, are humans mice? No, we're not. But, you know, Dr. Richard Weinreich actually had similar observations in a long, over 19-year study in primates, to whom we are a bit more similar. But I think that that is gaining more traction, and fewer calories and leaner bodies have already been in previous observational studies associated with greater longevity. Whole body vibration is actually very interesting, because in a very easy manner, standing on a device, we're exposing actually body to vibrational forces that help increase bone mass and strength while increasing muscle mass and toning muscles. In that similar category, but a bit different, are devices, and one that I'm particularly familiar with is the one that we're actually using in my practice to acute and chronic pain management to help patients who are battling opioid crisis improve. Dynamic neuromodulation actually enhances functioning of nerves and muscles, and it does strengthen the skeleton and the muscle as well, and it may have other anti-aging benefits. And then we already talked briefly about stem cells and, you know, pluripotent stem cells, which are currently acquired from tissues such as placentas. And there's work on them being manufactured in laboratory to replace the human sources. Seem to bring about a potential for repair, rejuvenating with them. You know, while the practice is not yet supported as standard of care, many clinics outside of U.S. are offering it, from rejuvenating skin to healing every organ and every in the body and reversing age clock by 10 to 15 years. You know, that is still to be seen, but clearly in aesthetic medicine, it has been in use. And those stem cells range from human stem cells derivative from human skin, such as in purified skin protein, or botanical skin cells. But many anti-aging researchers believe that the human origin is more effective. And then last but not least, the good old coffee. You know, if you are like me, having grown in Eastern Europe where coffee was part of a post-meal delight, I enjoy my morning cup of coffee and I enjoy maybe another cup of coffee, but real coffee, organic coffee, not the coffee look-alike sweet beverages. Studies in Japan showed that 3 to 4 cups a day actually led to a powerful 24% reduction in all-cause mortality. There are 2 studies published in my professional organization journal, Annals of Internal Medicine, with huge number of participants from all over the world, 186,000 people who drank 2 cups a day had 18% decreased risk of all-cause mortality. And European Society of Cardiology in August published a study that was astounding. 4 cups of coffee a day lowered risk of dying of any cause by 64% compared to those who never drank coffee. So, you know, antioxidants and polyphenols in coffee, I'm probably to thank for those effects. So for those coffee lovers out there, enjoy, but enjoy the good cup. So, you know, when it all boils down to something old, something new, something borrowed from ancient cultures, etc., incorporated into our lives using common sense and awaiting new things to come our way.
Nice. Thank you. So there are lots of options. So when we look at the solutions, there are some that are definitely benefiting all the areas of the body, like solutions focusing on mitochondrial health. And then there are solutions targeting very specific areas like the skin, for instance, with techniques like microneedling, because obviously the skin is such an important aspect of aging. So do you have any preference for one or versus the other?
Well, you know, I believe that support of a healthy, youthful body from enhancement of cellular well-being and energy production within the cell's energy powerhouses, the mitochondria, to expression of that well-being of the healthy body through the body's ability to perform optimally in, you know, a physical sense or with cognitive challenges is also a key to the youthful appearance. So, you know, the cliche of beauty from the inside out really isn't a cliche. It's very true. And there are definitely thousands of procedures out there that are directed at our vanity. You know, the quest to look younger, is really not what my patients are seeking these days. They really want to be, and the phrase should be, look and feel younger. And look and be younger. So all of those procedures, you know, have to be substantiated by scientific proof of efficacy. And many actually indeed do work and are supported. So when it comes to youthful looking skin, whether we use microneedling, which is intentional injury to trigger self-repair to ultimately increase elastin and collagen production, and combine it with treatments like PRP, platelet-rich plasma, you know, complete with many growth factors that enhance that process, or we intentionally deliver heat via laser technologies with the same intent, there are definitely going to be some temporary, beautiful, beneficial effects. And same is true of thousands of anti-aging skincare topical products that are currently on the market and continue to flood it daily with various claims. But no one should really deceive themselves, though, that those and often very costly products and procedures are the answer to longevity. My team of medical aestheticians and nurses indeed have outstanding library of before and after photos that truly altered the person's phenotypically their appearance, but without internally supporting them with a good choice of macro and micronutrients, particularly paying attention to micronutrients that combat the oxidative stress of daily exposure to toxins and daily targeted physical activity, none of those results are anything more than a false sense of slowing down the clock. So I guess it really is impossible to tease out and separate the importance of one from the other, as in the end, we're really the sum total of everything that goes on internally and externally.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm sure everybody would like to hear now what the best way is to support mitochondrial health and also the health of the key systems in our body. There are lots of supplements out there. What are your favorites and what would you recommend?
So our mitochondria are best supported with a diet that's rich in proteins, and those need to come from clean animal sources. So if you eat animals, they should be organic meats, wild-caught fish. But you can also get very good amino acids and proteins from seeds and beans and lentils and eggs, which all help to increase the famous glutathione, and supplementing with NAC, N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, nitric oxide boosters, B vitamins, magnesium, CoQ10, and NADH do the same. So making mitochondria happy with glutathione-inducing or glutathione-rich foods is the key. Now, my favorite way actually to look at supplements is to try to make it very simple, because it is a complicated and confusing world out there. Multi-billion-dollar industry, no regulation, and a lot of confusion. So how do I make it simple for my patients? Well, I create for them a core of foundational health supplementation, which really should include the following. We should support the healthy brain and endocrine system aging. We should balance the two arms of our immune system. And we should address the ever so important gut health, as you've already discussed on your first program, Brigitte, because it really gut is kind of where everything is and happens. So with that covered, we then may need to add some specifics like we discussed regarding mitochondrial health and good oils and perhaps additional vitamin D3 and K2. But in general, with that approach, we are covered. I only recommend supplements that are manufactured in FDA-approved facilities and followed the cGMP guidelines of production. As I said before, nutritional industry is overwhelmingly confusing to most of us, even medical professionals, let alone our patients. So I look for science behind the ingredients and ease of administration for best compliance, because you can have a cupboard full of nutritional supplements, but if there's 100 of them, you're not going to compliantly take them. If there is a handful, typically taken morning and evening, then I'm much more likely to comply, and they're much more likely to actually exert their effect than if they're sitting there unused.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. So now, in a previous Solari report, Catherine mentioned blood transfusions from younger people being used to increase longevity, or even energy harvesting from younger people as well. Have you heard about that? And what do you think?
Well, Brigitte, hot, that is hot and controversial topic. My first exposure to this concept was in 2015 when I had the privilege of being in company of Professor Rodman sitting in the beautiful courtyard of the Mediterranean Institute of Life Sciences in Split, Croatia. And Professor Rodman, who is a recent inductee into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and Professor Emeritus of Molecular Biology at University of Paris Medical School, has spent over 35 years studying cellular immortality of a microorganism called Deinococcus radiodurans and its resistance to oxidative stress and possible implications in human biology. He also, at that time, spoke of his collaboration with researchers from California who arrived at remarkable conclusions from parabiosis experiments in mice, connecting young and old animals' circulatory systems and essentially recreating youthful behaviors and biomarkers in the old animals. So that really totally fascinated me. And when I returned home, I kind of looked up the work of the California scientists, and fast forwarding to 2017 and 2018, U.S. scene, we are actually viewing another theory of fountain of youth unfold before us. So based on years of this research about cellular immortality that we spoke about at McGill's in Split, researchers at Stanford led by neuroscientist Tony Weiss-Corey showed that infusion of blood from young mice reversed cognitive and neurological impairments seen in old ones. So these findings may have enormous implication if they could be replicated in humans, whose extended life expectancy carries with the burden of both normal age-related cognitive decline, and I don't know how normal that is, but that's how it's termed in allopathic medical circles, and neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and ALS, which is becoming one of the biggest public health challenges worldwide, is the Alzheimer's and dementia. So a new study that was published last year by the same author in Nature, Weiss-Corey reported that plasma from human umbilical cords in young adults also had beneficial effects on old mice. So here we're talking, you know, mice to mice. Now we're mice to humans. But they also isolated a protein which may be responsible for those effects, providing a focus for research and development for new drugs that could rejuvenate age-related cognitive decline in the hippocampus. So while a small step, this is a small, you know, step towards testing in humans and done in a very scientifically appropriate way. However, then, you know, there's always this challenge where science possibly can be tied to premature enthusiasm and financial gain. And in last year, 2017, California company called Ambrosia launched the first U.S. trial to test the anti-aging effect of young blood in humans. But it really was not a true scientific experiment because participants had to pay $8,500 to participate. And that obviously raised a lot of ethical questions. Now, a company called Alkahest recently completed a more rigorous small safety trial in 18 Alzheimer's patients with no adverse effects, but no results on cognitive performance, which have yet to be reported. And those participants, you know, were enrolled in a traditional scientific trial without financial participation. Now, earlier this year in March, there was a day conference held in Palm Beach, which attracted a group of approximately 120 baby boomers from all over the world to learn about a possibility of participation in a clinical trial testing transfusion of young blood, those would-be donors 18 to 25, in an attempt to, quote, add a lot of healthy years to their lives, end of quote. And I tell you, a lot of eyebrows in the scientific community went up, particularly when they learned that participants would have to pay upwards of $200,000 to enroll, although that sum is still under discussion between the study principal investigator and the FDA. So, you know, how exciting is this? Well, if we could extrapolate the data from the murine model to humans, very exciting indeed. But there are many unanswered questions in this field, and many companies are looking into similar bases of research where they would be utilizing the pluripotent stem cells from human placentas and perhaps achieving similar results. So while it is out there, it is still not for prime time, and it's to be continued.
Yeah, definitely. So we've talked a lot about external solutions, and we know that there are other things people can do to increase longevity. And we've talked about some of those: diet, exercise, managing our emotions, what we think, what we believe, how we sleep, how we breathe. our social environment. So based on your experience, what you've seen with your patients and your own experience, what are the top three things that people can do tomorrow to increase their lifespan?
So, you know, it's not easy to isolate the top three because there are many wonderful things that we could do. But you have put me in the corner, so I'm going to go for it. Number one, allow your body to self-repair with better sleep. Americans are entirely tired and sleep deprived. So good quality sleep. Number two would be to eat a rainbow of vegetables and fruits and fatty fish. If you drink, drink alcohol in moderation and don't ever smoke. And exercise. Eat organic as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And number three, manage stress and reduce toxins. So in the manage stress category, and I guess I'm cheating because I'm lumping two things together here, but I think they're equally important. Exercise, socialize, engage in conscious breath work daily. You know, be a vegan for 10 days once a season to really sort of cleanse your body with supportive cellular detoxification program. And toxin proof, including EMF radiation exposure, your home and your workplace. And, you know, form a partnership with a trained medical professional to help you navigate through all of those choices and through all of the Dr. Google information and misinformation.
Yep, I agree with that. And what do you think of sugar? Should we just remove it totally from our diets?
Sugar is poison, and we get plenty of it, abundance of beautiful natural sugar from the array of colorful vegetables and fruits on our platter.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, good. So all this sounds reasonable and feasible, which is encouraging. So yeah, I think this is really, really good content. And I want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing all your wonderful knowledge and wisdom. If people are inspired to work with you, they can obviously find you online, and your website is
CCWM.com, stands for Comprehensive Center for Women's Medicine. And I really cannot thank you enough, Brigitte, for allowing me to share. This is a topic that I'm very passionate about, and I know we probably overextended our conversation and our time, but I could keep going for another hour. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And it was a real pleasure to speak with you today. This is Brigitte Mouchet with the Solari Report Wellness Series. Please leave your comments or questions on the blog for Dr. School or myself, and we'll respond as quickly as possible. Thank you for listening, and take good care of yourself, because it's more fun to be well.